We may take for granted nowadays that motorcycles have an inherent beauty, but only a few decades ago, our two-wheeled objects of affection still carried a rough around the edges, maybe even illegal connotation. $5 words aside, we have filmmaker and author Alton Guilfoyle to thank for changing society's view on motorcycles. After all, he's half of the team that brought the legendary The Art of the Motorcycle exhibit first to the Guggenheim Museum in New York City and then to Bilbao, Spain in the late 90s, which brought over 100 of the world's most iconic motorcycles together in one building, proving to the world that something well-designed can also be stunning to look at. Alton did it so well, in fact, that he was asked to put another motorcycle exhibition together in Australia, and he managed to pull it off even through the middle of the COVID pandemic. The best part? Both of Alton's exhibitions were immortalized in books full of amazing photos and descriptions, which means that even if you never got to see the exhibitions in person, you can have them on your coffee table. This is Alton Guilfoyle. I'm your host, Mark Long, and you're listening to Driven to Ride. All right, Alton Guilfoyle, you are on Driven to Ride. Thank you so much for being here and spending some time with us.
Hey, Mark, it's my pleasure. It was great to meet you at the Barber Museum recently. Listened to your podcast many times, and I'm thrilled to be here with you today.
Yeah, no, we're super excited. We appreciate the time. It was great to meet you at Barber as well. You've got a lengthy motorcycle history, and I'm excited to dive into it. But I want to start kind of at the beginning with you. Maybe in your own words, what do most people know you for? What's your claim to fame, or claims to fame, maybe in your case?
Well, you know, that's a funny question. I don't really have any. I'm a generalist, you know, and my family would laugh at me when you say that I've got a long history of motorcycling, because they see me as something completely different.
So
I grew up in Dublin in Ireland. I'm a lifelong avid art fan, so I love art, and I read art history in college in Dublin, and so my world has always been art and music. And very shortly after leaving college, I joined the BBC in London. I was a producer director there on music shows. Then I set up a production company with my friend Bob Geldof in London, and Bob and I did a number of music films. And art films, one of which was a film about Frank Lloyd Wright and the Guggenheim Museum in New York, which at the end of the 90s took me, the 1990s, that's the last century for those younger listeners. it took me to New York, where I eventually was invited by the Guggenheim to set up the film department, the first film department ever at a major museum. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and that's what brought me to New York, and that's what brought me to the Guggenheim. To answer your question specifically, my career really has been as a filmmaker and as a writer, particularly about architecture, design, and sometimes art itself. And so not so much motorcycles.
Well, not to spoil it, but, you know, your time at the Guggenheim, you were one of the men responsible behind the kind of legendary Art of the Motorcycle exhibit there, just to set the stage. But kind of as listening to you talking at the Barber Museum with Pierre, there is a lot of art and design and thought that goes into motorcycle design. So it's not as much of a stretch, I think, maybe as people think.
Well, indeed. I mean, so the Art of the Motorcycle, here's a poster actually I have on my wall here in my apartment in New York.
Yeah.
That was a poster used on the subway in New York City at the time of the exhibition. And I managed to snag a couple when they were removing them from the subway cars at the end of the exhibition. But to go back a little, it wasn't an accident that I was asked to do this exhibition, to curate the exhibition. I've been a bicycle rider.
Okay.
A motorcycle rider from a young age. I mean, bicycles, people of my generation in Europe, in England and Britain and Ireland, we lived on our bikes. We went to school on our bikes. We went to play sports on our bikes. We delivered newspapers on our bikes. We did everything on our bikes.
Sure.
As soon as we could, we found a motor for our bikes. In my case, I bought a NSU quickly, which is unusual in America. Americans don't really know this little moped, but the NSU quickly was a German moped with a 50cc two-stroke engine on it. And I bought that from a classmate at school for £1. and which is the equivalent of about 50 cents in those days. But what I didn't know was that I was supposed to put oil in the two-stroke mixture, in the gas mixture.
Oh, geez.
So I did some very hot laps around the orchard in our family home in Dublin. And the hottest was the very last one before it stopped running and never to run again. So that was my first motorcycle. But to bring further up to date with the Guggenheim, the boss of my boss at the time, Thomas Krenz, the director of the Guggenheim, was fond of saying that the Guggenheim was a collection of art and architecture, because the building on Fifth Avenue, 10 blocks from where I live now, was designed, of course, by Frank Lloyd Wright, the great American architect of the 19th and 20th century. And it was his last building, opened in 1959. And it's an amazing piece of individualist modernism. And it's certainly a landmark in New York City. So my boss Tom Krenz always said that, you know, the Guggenheim, the building itself, was the first object in the collection.
Sure.
Historically or in time, in a time sense, it wasn't the first, but it's certainly the one everybody recognizes. But people generally at that time, much more so now, didn't treat architecture as an art form.
Sure.
And indeed, for a good reason, it's not an art form. Architecture is a design form. And design is different from art in the sense that art doesn't have to do anything except be on the wall.
Sure.
Design has to do things. You know, if you design a building, it has to have plumbing and windows and heating and lighting and so on.
Yeah, there's no form following function in art necessarily.
Not at all. And that's the beauty of it. That's the liberation of it. So Frank Lloyd Wright took his ideas of 19th century Americana into a built form in the 20th century and evolved over the course of the century to end up where he did with the Guggenheim, which was an extraordinary expression of a spiral. He called it an inverted ziggurat. It was a great phrase. I mean, nobody really knew what it meant, but anyway, there was this upside down cone, and it became notorious and famous at the same time. A very difficult building to show art, or at least show painting in, because the ramps slope like this, and so the gallery walls are slope. So you hang a painting on it. You know, do you do it? You make it
right. You have to maybe adjust it.
You have to do it this way, you know.
Right.
So it's a skill. For sculpture, on the other hand, it's fantastic because you can pull it away from the walls, and you can see a sculpture from across the rotunda. You know, so you can be 100 feet from an artwork. You can see it from different angles. And so for me, we're jumping forward a bit, but for me, installing motorcycles in the rotunda was a thrill because it was like taking sculptures and three-dimensional objects and putting them up in space and allowing people to walk around them and see them from different objects and see them in a way that they'd never seen them before. And that was the purpose of it, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the beginning of the idea for the exhibit. I mean, how did the idea even come into play?
It wasn't my idea. That's for sure. It was Tom Krenz's idea. So there's a funny story there too. So Tom was a motorcycle rider, avid motorcycle rider. He rode his BMW to the office every day. Mm-hmm. I rode a motorcycle to the office as well. He and I understood that we both liked motorcycles and cars and things. And over a course of a couple of years in the 90s, he would say, you know, how many cars do you think we'd get in here? And I said, not many, Tom, you know, maybe 20 or 30. You know, you can't get any on the upper ramps because they get narrower as they go up.
Sure.
I said, you might get two or three down here and one or two there. And when, you know, you might get 20 total. He said, nah, I need 100. And I never knew really where he was going with that until one day I get a call from his office and Alton, Tom needs to see you. And I said, okay, I can come tomorrow or no, now.
And
So I walked into this meeting Tom was having with about 10 people, and I didn't recognize any of them. They were all in suits, men and women both, and all very quickly realized they were German and they were from BMW. And they were there to ask Tom if the Guggenheim would present an exhibition of German expressionist art. And the thing about the Guggenheim collection is it's got a lot of very good German expressionist art. And so BMW thought, well, that'd be great. An exhibition of German art, and we could get behind it. And it would be good for both of us. So sure. It dawned on me when I came into the room and took a seat that was being discussed, right? And then suddenly Tom said, I'd like to introduce Alton Guilfoyle. He's our curator of design. I wasn't his curator of design. He made that up on the spot.
Just roll with it, yeah.
I was in charge of the film department. But in any case, he said, and I kind of did a big gulp, where is this going? I'm just going to have to keep nodding my head. Right. So he said, Alton and I have been talking about an exhibition of motorcycles from the very first motorcycle, a Harley Davidson in 1900, right up to the present day. And I suddenly go, oh my goodness. The first motorcycle was not a Harley Davidson. It wasn't in 1900, but I have to keep quiet about that.
Right.
So I knew we were in trouble. So anyway, the meeting ended. The group from Germany could not have been nicer. I mean, really, they're top marketing people, they're top people, and they were all very brilliant. But they couldn't understand how they had got from German expressionist art to motorcycles like that.
Sure.
They left kind of shaking their heads, but they agreed. They said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. You know, fine. So then Tom and I really had to put our heads down, and he said, I want you to curate it. Pick 100. Let's make 100, like 100 for 100 years. And I said, yeah, but it's longer than 100 years, Tom, because the motorcycle, sure, as far as I know, and I haven't done much research, but the motorcycle goes back to, you know, 1875 or something like that. So he said, yeah, whenever. But like 100, roughly 100 in the rotunda. And, you know, Tom was a gesture guy. He wasn't a detail guy.
Sure. So, here's the idea. Let's just roll with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
You so make it happen.
I thought, oh, no, I'm in trouble now because, A, I'm busy with my own work. B, I'm busy with Guggenheim film work because I also had a career, a parallel career of my own.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, how am I going to do this? So I started buying books, as one does, and digging into the history. And the books kept telling me different things, like this was the first, that was the first. And the books were pretty loose about the facts. There was no Wikipedia then. There was no, you know, there was an internet, but it was very young.
Sure.
So I had a brainwave. I had met a guy on the internet, on one of the motorcycle chat forums about British bikes, who was a physics professor in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona, at the University of Arizona. Mm-hmm. And we had met because he was coming to New York and he said, look, I know by your email address that you're at the Guggenheim. Is that anything to do with the Guggenheim Museum? I said, it is. He said, well, could we meet? And I'd quite like to come to the Guggenheim. I said, yeah, sure. So we met and I brought him to an Ellsworth Kelly exhibition at the Guggenheim. We had a great time. We hit it off. Mm-hmm. We went and had a nice lunch and we became firm friends, and we're friends to this day. His name is Charles Fockel, and Charles is now a professor emeritus of physics at the University of Arizona. But I knew that he had a collection of publications about motorcycles, that he really had an academic approach. Even though he was a physicist, he understood the technology better than just about anybody. Sure. So I said, would you ever consider helping me out with this exhibition? And he said, No, I'm really busy, man.
Okay.
And I said, well, think about it on the, he was traveling somewhere. I said, think about it on the plane and let me know when you get to the other side. So he called me back. He said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. I'll help you out.
All it took was a plane ride. Yeah.
And so we became effectively co-curators of the exhibition. And he and I went through thousands of motorcycles from all sorts of places. And we defined how we would choose them. We defined them that they had to be of an aesthetic importance. In other words, they had to look great. That's a subjective, you know, measure. By, you know, but just like art is a subjective measure, you either like it or you don't. So it had to be aesthetically pleasing. It had to have some sort of technological importance. It had to do something that was, you know, something extra. And it had to have some sort of place in the culture, in the popular culture. So you think an obvious one you think of is the triumph in the Wild One with Marlon Brando draping his hands and the triumph badge. You know, there's obviously an image that you could gravitate towards and say, well, you know, we're going to have some interesting stuff here.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did that. That's how we started. And we, for a couple of years, Charles would send me a list of, you know, like a 500 motorcycles or a 1,000. we started with thousands. And he would send me little, you know, photocopied images alongside little thumbnails. And we just whittled them down. And occasionally Tom would ask me, how are you guys getting on with that motorcycle exhibition? Because we've got an opening date now. It's going to be 1997, summer 97. So, you know, you've got to be ready, you know.
Right, right.
I said, yeah, no, we're getting on fine. We've got a list. Show me a list. So I showed him a list and he kind of looked at it like this. It means nothing to me. So anyway, that's how we did it. And once we had kind of got to our list of about, a long list of about 150 bikes, mm-hmm. maybe even 200, we started thinking, this is all very well, but where are we going to find these bikes?
I was going to say, that's the other half. Yeah.
Oh man, that's the really big half. Because if you're curating an art exhibition, you know, say you're doing Picasso, you know where all the Picassos are. Some of them are part of collections, of course, but a lot of them are museums. So as a curator, if you're designing an exhibition of Picasso, you make 50 calls and you've got 40 yeses and 10 noes.
Sure.
But at least you've got an idea. It's streamlined. We had no idea.
Yeah, it's a whole different ball game. Yeah.
So that was an interesting thing. So when it really started to get close to like a year out from the exhibition or a little bit more, maybe 18 months, I started trying to figure out who had these bikes. And so one of my first calls was to George Barber in Birmingham.
Good start.
Yeah. But, well, I had no idea. So I had no idea what to expect. I just knew that this man in Birmingham, Alabama had a collection of outstanding cars and motorcycles. Mm-hmm. And I gave him a call. And I didn't get him. He was a busy businessman running a business and real estate business. But I got the director of the museum, Jeff Ray, and I said, told him what we were doing, told him who we were. And I said, can we come down and visit you and talk about you participating in this exhibition? And he said, yeah, sure. But I could tell by the way he put down the phone that he didn't really believe that I was from the Guggenheim. And I don't blame him.
Yeah.
So anyway, Charles came from Tucson. We made a time that worked for him and worked for me. We flew down and we walked into the old dairy in downtown Birmingham, Alabama. And, you know, the business had moved on out to finer premises outside town, sure. But it was an old 19th century dairy. And so it didn't look all that interesting, you know. Just as a door, the Barber Museum knocked on the door, opened, went in and met Jeff, who was with his chief curator, you might call him Brian Slock, sure. Who has subsequently become a great friend. And he's a legend in motorcycle history. But Jeff and Brian were standing there. And so I introduced myself and I introduced Charles. And there was this tall, forbidding figure standing behind us. And I didn't know, behind them. And I didn't know who that might be. I thought, well, it's just a guy. And after about 10 minutes, he stepped forward and said, George Barber. And
it was
him. But he just wanted to, because he didn't believe it either. Jeff said, I had this guy from the Guggenheim Museum in New York calling and saying he wanted to just do an exhibition of motorcycles. And he said, no, that'll never happen. And,
okay, whatever, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So then we knew we were in good shape when we saw the collection. Charles and I had a little checklist of must-haves, like 25 must-haves or maybe 50 must-haves.
The iconic.
We don't have these, we have nothing, right? We can fiddle around the edges, but we have to get these. And I saw 10 or 50 of them just looking over Jeff's shoulder.
Oh, really?
It was going in my mind. I was going, there's that, that's that, that's that.
Yeah.
So I thought we're in great shape. And so that was the beginning of a very long relationship. George subsequently invited me to be on the board of the Barber Museum. Mm-hmm. The Barber Museum now, as you know, is probably the most important automotive museum, design museum in the world. Certainly motorsports museum. And for cars, it's got some of the most outstanding historic race cars ever, including John Surtees' Formula One winning Ferrari. A number of Porsches, a number of really outstanding cars. And then on bikes, it just has the best collection of the best motorcycles from the very beginning. And by the way, there's a racing track right next door.
Oh, it's attached. That's right.
So
that's right.
You take out one of these things, take it off its pedestal, prep it, fire it up, and let Kenny Roberts go and ride a few laps around the track. I mean, you know, it's amazing.
Do you remember a couple of those? You said you had those like kind of 25 or 50 must-haves. Do you remember which ones that kind of were at the very, very top of the list?
Yeah, I mean, sure. So a Triumph Bonneville. If you're thinking of British bikes, a Triumph Bonneville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, naturally.
A Speed Twin, a Triumph Speed Twin, which is the kind of era of Marlon Brando that I was talking about, which was a groundbreaking motorcycle in terms of design and technology. Mm-hmm. A BMW, you know, you could almost throw a stone over your shoulder at BMWs and pick any one that landed on. But, you know, we really wanted the R32, the very first BMW, because it told a story about technology and design. And the story essentially was that, you know, BMW after the First World War was not in the business of making arms or airplanes anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, the BMW Roundel is a propeller. There's blue and white. And that comes from its days as an aircraft manufacturer. And the engine of the Boxer engine, Boxer to suggest this, you know, it's like back and forward, like boxers in a ring. The Boxer engine was so designed so that the cylinders could be in the airflow of an airplane. So, you know, the propeller is on the front, but the cylinder's in the air, so that keeps them cool. So you had all, and it was a shaft drive, you know, mm-hmm. no chain, because the designer understood what he was dealing with in early 20s Germany. You know, not very good roads, not very good weather. Try and keep everything as oil tight as possible, whereas everybody else had chains and they always broke and got messy and got disgusting. You know, it was a really bad deal. I mean, in the early days, there were leather belts, of course.
Yeah.
I spent quite a lot of time in Munich, mm-hmm. a lot of time in their museum, which is a beautiful museum. Mm-hmm. Saw everything they had and made my choice with Charles on what BMWs we wanted for the exhibition. And they didn't have everything we wanted, actually. But everything that we did want, they had and were prepared to. Or everything that we wanted that they had, they were prepared to lend and send over. And so I think one or two we picked up here. But that's how we did it. Harley, American motorcycles, of course, the first Indian, first Harley, early Harley board trackers. Board tracking was a big phenomenon in early America, board track racing. And it came from the velodromes, the wooden velodromes, which are bicycle racing. Particularly in Europe, where it was a spectator sport, and they in America they just made it bigger and bigger and stopped running bicycles on them and put motorcycles on them. And so the board track racing, early board track racing bikes like the Harleys and the Indians, they were really important to get. And then on up into the contemporary era, you know, collection of Ducatis. Miguel Tamburini designed Ducatis like the 916. He also mm-hmm. designed the Augusta MV Augusta F4 750, which was the last bike in our exhibition, actually.
Oh, cool.
And that was a Tamburini design. Miguel Galuzzi with the Ducati Monster. I still ride a Ducati Monster.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know, Charles and I were in Italy visiting Ducati and MV. And we actually put our hands on the first engines to come off the the MV Agusta F4 engines to come off the assembly line.
That's cool.
And one of them was in the exhibition. So that was the short list, if you like. I mean, so just the obvious must-haves. Mm-hmm. It's easy to get a must-have from a contemporary bike. You know, it's more difficult to get a must-have from, you know, an early board tracker. But, you know, the collectors of early American bikes, Otis Chandler, famous collector, passed away since, became a very close friend and very generous lender to the exhibition. So he and George Barber were the two single biggest lenders to the exhibition.
I got you. Yeah, it speaks to the motorcycle community that people are usually very friendly and very generous, and that's nice to know that it goes kind of all strata of motorcycle owners and collectors, no matter how big or how small.
You're absolutely right about that, Mark. And I think it applies to cars as well. I think car owners are similarly generous. Of course, we dealt with the manufacturers where it was appropriate. Harley-Davidson were very helpful.
Sure.
Initially dismissive, actually. You know, they thought, we're in Milwaukee. I mean, we don't have any Harley riders in New York City.
Sure.
But then they, you know, Willie G. Davidson was a wonderful man, a brilliant designer, but he became a friend and they lent to the exhibition as well. So yeah.
Interesting.
You made a comment earlier on, which I want to pick up on, that design has the quality of art sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that's why the exhibition was called The Art of the Motorcycle. It was a deliberately, you know, spiky, you might say, title because
right.
The art world in New York is fairly snooty, you might say.
And well, I mean, it's up there with Paris, Milan, London. I mean, it's world class, yeah.
Well, yeah, and so Tom just likes tweaking people, and I think for him to call it The Art of the Motorcycle was a real tweak. But what he meant and what I understood by the term was that, you know, at its finest, the motorcycle or any designed object at its best has the quality of art about its shape and form. And when a really good designer brings his or her thinking to the object, you're going to get something good.
What was the reaction from maybe the art world and let's say the general public, you know, when those subway advertisements started going up with The Art of the Motorcycle and maybe people started coming into the Guggenheim to see it? What were some of the initial reactions to the exhibit?
It's funny, you know, years go by and you look back and people say, oh, that was controversial.
Right.
It wasn't that controversial. It was a blockbuster in the sense that I didn't even understand where that word comes from. When the line goes around the block, that's literally a blockbuster.
Literally, yeah. And that's what you had on your hands, yeah.
The line to get into the Guggenheim, into the Art of the Motorcycle, was unlike any that had ever been seen before. It was literally a blockbuster from day one. And that was thrilling. The reviews were incredibly kind. Robert Hughes was an Australian polymath and writer and design critic, art critic. And he wrote a review in the New York Time magazine. That was a complete rave review. And so that carried the art world along with them to an extent. Now, other museums weren't as kind, and I'll tell you why.
Interesting.
So the Met down the road from the Guggenheim has its own fashion institute. So that's just a euphemism for a place where you can show fancy clothes. But because it's a fashion institute, they feel that fashion is perfectly good subject for exhibition, which it is.
Sure.
Now, but the Guggenheim doing not fashion in this case, but motorcycles, design, like outrageous. They're German expressionists. They're kind of, you know, contemporary art. They're not design. Like, how dare they? So there was that going on.
Interesting.
But it was, you know, professional jealousy more than anything else. The public loved it.
Oh, sure.
In the middle of the week, moms with kids were in there pointing at things and trying to peel their children off the bikes. at the weekends, a big crowd of bikers would descend. And we did a fun thing. So our head of marketing was a very wonderful woman, and she called the NYPD and said, could you just clear the front of the museum of all parking and could you just kind of put up a sign that says only motorcycle parking allowed?
Oh, smart.
And they said, yeah, okay, that's fine. We can do that. So they changed all the signs. They put motorcycle parking only.
And that's cool. That's super smart. 100
motorcycles on a Saturday or Sunday morning. That was very cool. So, yes, so that was the public reaction. And the critical reaction was similar because we had a pretty good collection of bikes, and we backed it up. I mean, thanks to Charles Falco, my partner on this endeavor, we were able to back it up with real science and real history. Not only was it an exhibition, but we brought a really substantial catalog out to back us up. And we wrote about, you know, the motorcycles and the design trends that out of which the motorcycles came. So we weren't just putting, we weren't just throwing 100 bikes in the exhibition. It was kind of 125, I think, in the end. But it wasn't just lining up a whole bunch of old bikes and opening the door. No,
we actually, having no context. Yeah, it's almost like we did almost like you kind of curatorial work. Yeah, you almost created and curated, for that matter, like the definitive history of the motorcycle up till that point.
Well, certainly to that point, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that you changed, like, so, okay, so you have the art world, rave reviews, public rave reviews, the motorcycle industry. Do you think that you had an impact with the exhibition on the motorcycle industry in terms of maybe how people think of design and art, like, for lack of a better term, the art of the motorcycle?
Yeah, absolutely. I think very much so, in fact. Because particularly in the United States, there was this belief that motorcycles were dirty, loud, slightly criminal. The motorcycle gang idea, violent and outlaw, was still very much in people's popular imagination.
Yeah, in the 90s,
and that came down from the wild one, you know. And so even by the 90s, you know, that still was there. Mm-hmm. That didn't exist in Europe largely. I mean, in Europe, out of Ducati, Miguel Galuzzi designed the Ducati Monster. I mean, it's just such a spectacular bike, and it's designed to be light and easily ridden by as easily by a 16-year-old girl as it would be by a 60-year-old guy. So that was a very special design, and there was nothing threatening, or there was no negative vibe attached to that design.
No criminality or underworld. With, yeah, yeah.
No. Same with BMW. BMWs were just, well, their brand is all about, you know, beauty and
refinement,
engineering, and the best of the best. So there was none of that. But in the United States, there was. So we certainly blew that out of the water completely. We just changed everybody's popular opinion about what motorcycles should be. Mm-hmm. viewed or perceived in, and their place in popular culture. So that changed enormously. And I think, I know definitely the advertising changed around motorcycles very much at that time. Now, there had been, other people had brought a kind of more wholesome thing to motorcycle design, motorcycle marketing and perception. Honda had an ad that said, "You meet the nicest people on Honda."
Yep, I was hoping you were going there.
Well, yeah. So, Soichiro Honda, who is the founder of Honda and the great designer, the great thinker behind about the modern motorcycle, he was the one who kind of ushered in that idea of you meet the best, nicest people on Honda, and it was around the Honda Cub, the 50cc Cub, that was really enveloped. So that was in the air, but it hadn't really permeated into America at that stage. And after our exhibition did, you know, so there were a lot of, you know, copy and advertising copy that used art, design, and motorcycles in the same line. And that had never happened before.
Yeah. That's pretty cool to be able to kind of see the impact that you had from going, "Oh, well, I'm in a heap of trouble. How am I going to do this project?" to changing the motorcycle industry that way.
And the motorcycle industry were very quick on the uptake. You know, we got to know them. They were very keen. They were calling us up saying, "How can we help?"
Very cool.
And, you know, I got invited to things. I got invited to talk to things. I got invited to ride a lot of motorcycles.
Not a bad thing. Yeah, not a bad thing.
They were keen. So it met its moment, and they met their moment too. Mm.
Interesting. Well, You hinted at it earlier, and so we'll switch gears to it. This was not the last motorcycle exhibition that you guys had put together. In fact, you had been asked to do it again in Brisbane, Australia.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that all came to be?
So Charles Falco, my partner in crime, Charles was giving a physics lecture in Australia and was approached by a gentleman who asked, would he be interested in revisiting the idea of a motorcycle for the 21st century? So ours was a retrospective, you might say.
Sure.
It was looking past from the vantage point of the end of the 20th century. And we didn't see electric vehicles coming, you know. So there were lots of things that we didn't see coming. And as I've been saying, there were some of the things, the developments arose directly from the work that we did in that exhibition.
Right.
But we really were about 20th century. And in a moment, I'll tell you a little bit more about the conception of the exhibition. But in any case, jumping forward, around 2018, Charles met this guy who was a senior figure at the biggest museum in Australia, Kagoma, the Queensland Art Gallery and Museum of Art in Brisbane, who asked him he didn't realize I was involved, and would he be interested? And he said, well, I'll think about it. So he immediately called me and said, there's a guy who wants to maybe do it again. And I said, I'm not doing that again. We've done it already. Why would we want to do that? You know, and
sure.
Great. And we go to Australia, you know, Great Barrier Reef.
Right.
Sydney, you know. Yeah. I had never been to Australia. And in fact, it was on my bucket list, and certainly to bring my family. I really wanted them to come. But so he and I talked about it, and we said, well, we might do it if they gave us a lot of latitude to move past this exhibition here on the wall and design something completely new. Now, we might still refer to the very first motorcycle, the Perrault from Paris, which we identified, a little steam
from
Paris.
Sure.
We would still start there because that's like having the first iPhone in your hand, you know, and you just say, this is the first, you know. So there's something compelling about that in storytelling terms. So he and I talked about it, and we said, well, if they agree to let us do this, then we'd be interested. So we called them, and there were many calls, but they basically gave us carte blanche to do whatever we wanted. And what we wanted to do was look at the 21st century as it was emerging. So that was 2017, 2018, something like that.
Yeah.
Those conversations were going on. And we were beginning to see EVs and hybrids and things like that really come into the marketplace, not so much in motorcycles, but certainly in cars. So we knew there was something going on. We were seeing Segways, the self-balancing device.
Oh, yeah. I remember those.
They have. Now, you know, the one wheel is a self-balancing one wheel. So we thought, if we can have two wheels, three wheels, one wheel, or even no wheel. And so the people in Australia were very, very sweet and funny and indulgent. And they said, what do you mean no wheel? And it turns out at the time I was working with an architect, Renzo Piano, in Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
And in Texas is the head of Bell Helicopters. And I met the CEO of Bell, who told me they were working on a two-passenger tandem drone copter that would come up and pick you up in your home. You'd sit on it and you'd drone away into your destination. And they had this thing flying around in their test grounds in Texas.
That's unreal.
And I said, would you land it? He said, I think that would be hard, but you could certainly refer to it. So anyway, a no wheel, a one wheel, a two wheel, and a three wheel. That was what we were looking at. And we were going to do half of it from the 21st century. So only retaining less than half of this exhibition. And maybe a third of this exhibition, and then going in a completely different direction for the others. So we agreed to do that. And I set about thinking about it, and Charles set about thinking about the technology side. And then the pandemic hit us. And we had already agreed maybe 10 or 15 loans from China. We had already agreed 20 loans from Japan. I had loans coming from all over Europe. They all stopped like that. Australia was in lockdown. The Europeans shut their factories. And the European law is that if you're an employee in a company in Europe, outside of ours, your phone doesn't work. So you can't call somebody in the middle of the night and say, can you do this? It just doesn't work. So all our loans went. So I wrote a note by hand to the director of the museum in Paris, who owns the Perrault. And I said, you know, we have this pandemic. If we go ahead, can we be assured we'll get your bike at least? And she wrote back. She called me, actually. She said, it's still in its crate. I put it in its crate a couple of weeks ago. So it's in its crate and it's going to stay in its crate. And if we can get it to Australia, we will. So we, in 2020, the pandemic hit us all in March of 2020. I had just come back. Charles and I had just come back from Australia. We'd had an amazing, that was our second of two trips. We had amazing time. We were planning the exhibition. It was going to open
sure.
in June. And it was going to be a huge blockbuster. And it was going to open in November.
Okay.
And that was timed to Thanksgiving for us here. So
oh,
I
sure.
was going to bring my family and we were going to have a vacation in Brisbane. And the pandemic locked us down. So then we kind of muddled along and we thought, well, what's going to happen? Because nobody knew what was going to happen, right?
Right. We're all just kind of sitting there waiting.
We're all waiting. And so, and you know, and it was a really bad time. You know, people were dying all around us and, you know, so it was bad. So we had a call in June of that year, end of June, with Chris Haynes, the director of Kagoma, amazing guy, brilliant curator himself, brilliant art historian, and running, you know, arguably the best museum in that part of the world, no question. So Chris said, we have a decision to make, gentlemen, to Charles and me on the phone. And he said, you know, I'm prepared to take a huge risk here. And with the government and with all our funders and our, you know, audience, I'm prepared to say, yes, we'll go ahead and open. But you have to be honestly look me in the eye and say, we can get the loans. Like, you can get these objects because you can't get Chinese objects. You can't get Japanese objects. You can't, you know, da, da, da.
Right.
So I took a deep breath. I said, yeah, we can get it. So we got to work. I hit the phones, basically. I had some very, very good friends in Australia who helped me.
Okay.
And, every single night I was talking to two or three of my friends. And the time difference being what it was, these calls were at 11 o'clock in my time.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're doing this in like almost the middle of the night, trying to get these deals done and get people to loan you motorcycles.
100%. And my family were all asleep when I was at my desk, kind of like, could you lend us that Moto Guzzi?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got some great loans from the United States for that. We got the world's fastest Indian. There are two world's fastest Indians. There's one in New Zealand. Bert Munro, who built and developed the world's fastest Indian, played by Anthony Hopkins in that marvelous film.
But right.
Bert Munro had two bikes. He had
okay.
one here and he had one in New Zealand. And he would come over for the salt flat trials at Bonneville. He would come over with an engine in his suitcase and he would rebuild the engine of the bike here. And the bike here is now down in Texas and it's a precious thing. The people in
right.
New Zealand said, no, we're not lending you the bike. We don't want you to go to Australia. We don't, you know, it's our treasure here. And I don't blame them. They, you know, they wanted their bike, but the owner of the one here agreed. And so we made a special crate for it and it was flown out to Australia and it was a star of the show. But we also looked at other things as well. So we never, in the Guggenheim exhibition, we hadn't looked at customization really. Customization
oh, sure.
was not a big deal then. I mean,
I was going to say that was right before the big custom scene hit in like the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s.
Exactly. So we didn't look at it. We had a replica of the Easy Rider Harley Davidson in
oh, sure.
the show owned by Otis Chandler, but we didn't, and that was the only replica. We didn't want to put replicas in our exhibition, but that
right.
one was an important design statement, so we felt it needed a green. But the whole customization idea from the late 20th and early 21st centuries, we really wanted to look at that, and so
sure.
we did, and so. A lot of the bikes, that important bikes from that world, were in our exhibition. That exhibition went ahead. We scrambled. We worked hard.
You pulled it off.
And we pulled it off. The tragedy was I never got to go and see it. I
saw
it on Zoom. My colleagues would call me every day from, you know, from Facebook and show me a FaceTime and say, look at this, look at this.
Walk you around it, yeah. Yeah.
Walk me around. But it was amazing, partly because people were locked down in Australia. So an opportunity to go out to an exhibition masked And
right, and distance.
Stand in line outside. There had to be distancing rules and protocols and so on. But the opportunity to go out with a with your family was just too good to pass up. So the exhibition was a runaway success. And we never got to see it.
That's kind of bittersweet. I mean, I guess you have the book as a small consolation and to be able to look back on it. But, you know, the feeling of fulfillment that you pulled it off and it was a great success, but the bitter pill that you didn't get to see it.
No, exactly. But in a lovely coincidence, one of the biggest lenders to that exhibition in Australia was George Barber. So when I called the museum and said, we're doing this thing in Australia, would you consider it? They said, yep, whatever you want. And to be able to do that and to be so generous to me personally was extraordinary. And I'll always be thankful. So they were the ones who stepped up very much for the first exhibition at the Guggenheim. And then they didn't have to say yes for the second one in Australia. We were in the middle of a lockdown. We were in the middle of a pandemic, but they said yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, going back to, I think just the spirit or the kind of character, I guess, maybe to a degree that the motorcycle world or motorcycles in general just attracts to is that there is this kind of communal generosity that people are willing to help each other out, again, from the biggest collectors down to just somebody riding just a motorcycle just for fun. It's pretty wild.
You're so right about that. And I think back to the first trial I ever rode. So I was a trials rider. I love trials.
Oh, really? Okay.
And trials is unknown in the United States pretty much. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a little bit of trials riding. But I remember going up to a man called Michael Orr in Dublin at a trial. Mm-hmm. I was about 14 years old. And it was a junior trial that the club that I was a member of was, mm-hmm. was running. And I didn't have a bike, you know. I was a 14-year-old schoolboy.
Right.
And Michael was one of, I knew him because I was in the club and so on, and I'd see him every weekend, but he was one of the best trials riders in Ireland. And I went up to him. He was riding his brand new Montesa Coat at 250cc. And I said, Michael, would you let me ride your bike in the trial? And he looked at me with astonishment, like, I can't believe this guy is asking me to ride my new trials bike. And he said, yeah, okay, if you're careful.
If you're careful.
And I was. It was my first trial on a Montesa 250 Kota.
Wow.
And just, he was an extraordinarily generous guy. But it's your point that motorsports people generally have a generosity of spirit. And I think it may have to do with the fact that we break down a lot and we need help. And so if we need help, we're more likely to give help.
Yeah. Yeah. There's, I can't remember who or where I read it or who said it, but I want to say it's maybe Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, or it could be Peter Egan. I don't know, but it was, there's a vulnerability to riding motorcycles that make people want to stop and help you. And I think that's part of what attracts to it as well. And if you're a fellow rider, you know that vulnerability firsthand. So it makes you more apt to want to help somebody out.
Exactly. Exactly. I remember meeting Prime Minister of France at the exhibition in Bilbao, and he was there as a civilian and not really recognizable. But he told me that he had been out riding recently and saw a guy broken down, pulled over. He had a full face helmet. Nobody would know who he was.
Sure.
And he had two Range Rovers of security detail behind him who pulled over wondering what on earth is going on.
Oh, God.
Guy ran out of gas. So he just said, I'll get you gas. So he rode forward. But stopped at the nearest gas station, got a can, filled it up, gave it to the Range Rover, sent it back. So the guy never knew until this Range Rover appeared and there was a can of gas for him.
Yeah. Imagine being that rider. Yeah. You have one motorcyclist and then two black Range Rovers, I'm sure, fully tinted windows just coming up. That's
totally, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Our friend, our boss told you to give you this gas. Good luck.
You know, never knew who it was. Yeah. Well, Alton, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you for sharing your stories of pulling off these two amazing landmark exhibitions and kind of showcases of the world of motorcycles and sharing how you pulled it off and the result and all that. I don't even feel like we scratched the surface of talking about motorcycles, so we'll have to have you on again and and talk about your riding and riding in New York City. There's so much to talk about. So I'd love to have you on again if possible.
Happy to do it anytime, Mark. It was a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. So, and before we go, where can people find your work? Pick up the two books from the exhibitions. Find out more about you. Where can they find all that?
Well, this book sadly has been out of print for years. And
okay,
I met Tom Krenz, my old boss, who's now mm-hmm. retired. I met him at the Guggenheim in Bilbao a couple of years ago, and he said to me that he was buying these on eBay now because they were going for $300 or $400.
And okay.
He said the really valuable ones are the ones with your autograph. He said that to me. He said, nobody cares about my autograph. And I don't think anybody even knows it is my autograph. This one isn't even autographed. So this one of mine, I don't have my own autograph on it. So that's out of print. You can get it in those places where historic books are sold, or Abe Books, or any of the old bookstores, booksellers. This one is widely available. The Motorcycle okay. Design Art Desire by Charles Falco and myself. And that's published by, by Fiden, but that's widely available. And so you can get that. Yeah. And I'd encourage people to do it. They're beautiful books. Even if I say so myself.
Yeah, the way the books are designed, the covers look beautiful. So ultimately, yeah, thank you again. This won't be a goodbye for now. It'll be a see you next time for sure. So thank you again.
Okay. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks for listening to Driven to Ride. Interact with us and check out full unedited conversations, photos, interviews, video interviews, plus other goodies on YouTube or Instagram at Driven to Ride Podcast. Or you can check us out at DrivenToRidePodcast.com. And make sure you leave us a rating and review from wherever you get your podcasts, too. If you have an idea for an episode or a guest, or you want to invite us out on an adventure, email us hello@DrivenToRidePodcast.com. Driven to Ride is wholly owned by Flint Rock LLC, made possible with help from Matthew Miles, and written, hosted, and produced by me, Mark Long. We'll see you out there.